Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Hey, y'all. I want to let y'all know that you can get more small doses. Yes, I am now doing weekly small doses bonus episodes, and they are for my people at the SEAL Squad. So if you ain't getting enough of this, baby, there is more for you. This is a little taste of what you're getting. I want to just bring something to you guys' mind space that I want to keep as an ongoing trend here on our bonus episodes. I have really been committing myself to intentional learning, not just passive learning, but intentional learning. So every week, I try to do some version of intentional learning about a topic. So this week, my intentional learning was about Vietnam. So I made it my business to watch the Ken Burns documentary on Vietnam. It's intentional learning. It's not passive learning. Passive learning is when you're like listening to this podcast or you're like scrolling on Instagram and it's kind of like you catch whatever you catch. That's passive learning. Intentional learning is like, I'm not just listening to a podcast. I am specifically going to listen to this podcast about this thing because I want to intentionally learn about it. Maybe it's because you heard someone speak about something and you want to get more information on it. You know, maybe you have a dormant curiosity about something that you decide that you want to lean more into. But I want us to challenge ourselves to do some form of intentional learning about something every week. And I would love for us to then report back to each other right here, whether it's in the chat while we're recording or in the comments on Patreon, to share not necessarily the expansiveness of what you learned, but to at least share, this is the thing that I decided to learn more about this week. A spoonful of sugar makes all that go down. And let me tell you something, I'm having a great time getting to be more connected with y'all because when we do the small doses bonus episodes, we do them live. So you get to be in the chat interacting with yours truly. So if you've been thinking about, do I want to join Patreon? Now is the time. Become a member of the SEAL Squad and expand your love of the small doses. Get you more doses, small doses bonus episodes at patreon.com. Yes, y'all, it is happening. I am back on tour. I took a little break during March, but yes, we are hitting the road in April. I will see you all in Fort Worth, Texas on April 12th, 13th, and 14th with four stand-up comedy shows and a screening slash political forum of my political comedy documentary In Amanda We Trust. Go out and get your tickets. I'm so happy to get to be back up in front of you all telling these jokes and bringing this funny. You can also catch me in Stamford, Connecticut. I will be in Stamford, Connecticut at the end of the month. And you can catch me out there doing stand-up. And the tickets are pretty much sold out almost. So I would love for you all to really like hammer that down and lock it in. I'll also be in Baltimore and I'll be in Boston in May. I'm going to be in Raleigh in May. And then in June, I'm going to be in Detroit. What up, though? We're also going to be announcing dates in Philly, in Toronto, in London. Brilliant. Cheers. As well as cities like DC, New York, and LA. So make sure that you go to my website, amandaseals.com, and sign up for the newsletter so that you can make sure that you are not left out when we are coming out to your town, all right? Also want to remind you that if you have not signed up for my Patreon, baby, what are you doing? We just launched a brand new tier, the Baldwin tier, named for, of course, the legend himself, James Baldwin. And it is on this tier that you can watch the videos of your favorite Small Doses podcast. Yes, I know we was usually putting them on YouTube, but I had to let it go. Let it go. So now you can get tapped into your Small Doses videos over at Patreon every week in the Baldwin tier. You'll also get access to other clips and videos, and you'll get access to my stand-up comedy and to lives that I'll be doing, just, you know, talking about things and painting and all of the above. It really is me just trying to expand the Patreon space to really be a network that gives you a lot of content from a lot of spaces and places that are stamped with the Amanda Seals approval. So that's what's going down over at Patreon. Please do yourself a favor. Check it out. You can always unsubscribe if you feel like it's not worth your time. And that's really the reality of the thing. Now, I also want to remind you that when you subscribe to Patreon, you also get access to Small Doses bonus episodes. Small Doses bonus episodes are done weekly. You can participate by being in the live chat while I'm recording the episode. And they're more of a personal experience because I talk about my week as Amanda Seals, the person, not just Amanda Seals the brand. We're not talking about, you know, just like the opinions as they are related to the nuances of socio-political discourse. Nah, we're talking about life. So make sure that you, if you want to hear more Small Doses and you want to get more Seals, well, you know what to do. Go to Patreon Amanda Seals, or you can get there by going to theamandaverse.com. Last but not least, I do care about sociopolitical conversations, and I think there's a lot of folks that are really trying to get their head wrapped around new ideas and thoughts that are not new to the world, but are new to them. Thoughts around voting uncommitted, thoughts around imperialism, thoughts around activism, etc. So I have been making it my business to give platform to those people and have conversations that can really pour into y'all. And it's happening on my YouTube, Amanda Seals TV. I call it the Common Sense Kickback. So subscribe to YouTube and make sure that you check them out. It's been really special to be able to also platform voices that aren't in mainstream media, you know, that aren't necessarily having a million followers, but definitely have the thoughtfulness and the humanity that we need to be platforming and advocating and amplifying. So there you go. You got AmandaSeals.com so you can get my stand-up comedy shows. You got Patreon so you can get Small Doses, the bonus episodes, as well as the videos. And you got YouTube for Amanda Seals, the Common Sense Kickback. All you got to do is go to Amanda Seals TV on YouTube. Your girl is busy. You hear me? And you know what? We got more to do right now. So let's get into this episode of Small Doses Podcast. We were so honored to get to talk to Brandon Scott, the mayor of Baltimore, the brother who is the mayor of Baltimore. And he has been having a real tough week. So let's get into the episode of Small Doses Podcast. It's so funky. So we recorded this episode with Baltimore's Mayor Brandon Scott last year when I was in D.C. for the Congressional Black Caucus. And I got to tell you that I never would have imagined that when we airs this episode that we would be watching Mayor Brandon Scott be disparaged as the DEI mayor for his being mayor when a freighter rammed into the Key Bridge in Baltimore, watching it tumble to the ground and killing, unfortunately, a number of workers on the bridge. This DEI takedown is the latest in the right-wing conservative effort to create boogeymen to just rally their following of fearful racists. Before, it was CRT, and before that, it was woke. It really just becomes another euphemism for the N-word. And that is exactly what they're saying when they say things like, oh, the DEI mayor, Brandon Scott. Let me make it very clear. Baltimore is a 70% Black city. Brandon Scott did not win the mayorship by a DEI decision. He won it by the decision of his constituency. And even if he had, just by chance, won the mayorship by DEI, which is not a thing, DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion, along with affirmative action, is not, nor has it ever been, about lowering standards. It is about expanding the access to the people who have the standards. When we live in America, where this is a constitution that has been written originally to only make room for landowning white men, it has taken centuries and effort to expand that intentionally. And in order to do that intentionally, there has to be language. When we're watching the takedown of DEI right now, we're watching the takedown of the intentional efforts of this country to reverse its intentional efforts to suppress and oppress. That is what is happening. And don't let anybody tell you otherwise. So let's go into this next episode with Mayor Brandon Scott of Baltimore. So, you know, this whole thing about government is a new thing that I'm very much learning at the same time as y'all are learning about it. But there are people who've really like been in this thing from jump. Like they got out of school and they was like, I'm about to get in this and I'm about to do this. And I can't even fathom that as like a mind state. But I think a lot of it too is just like where you were born, you know, where you grew up, like where you was at. And like you looking around and you like, it got to be better than this, right? So that is what brings me to interviewing our guest today, Mayor Brandon Scott of Baltimore. And this brother is 36. And when I tell you that the ageism that he be getting is wild, which is also the irony of it for me, is that on one hand, this country loves to grow up Black people. We love to grow up Black children. We love to treat Black children like they are adults. And then when Black people are actually in adult positions at an age that they feel like is not old enough. Now it's, oh, well, you're not mature enough, or you're not old enough, or you're not wise enough to be in this role. And it's just like the goalpost is constantly changing. The goalpost is constantly changing. So I'm really excited to get to talk to this brother about the work that he's doing in a city where, I don't know about y'all, but I feel like a lot of people looked at Baltimore for a long time as like, ooh, Baltimore. You know what I'm saying? Like, when someone say they're from Baltimore, Maryland, you like, ooh, Baltimore. And I know a lot of that is because we saw The Wire and we're like, ooh, Baltimore. But the only way that that changes, the only way that that ooh, Baltimore changes is by somebody deciding, like, you know what? I'm really going to put my foot in this. Like, that's what we see with Newark, New Jersey. For a long time, it was, ooh, Newark. But, you know, we got folks that came into Newark and said, no, we're going to really do our thing to try and lift this up. And there's always going to be people that are there to try and get in the way of that, who are like, nah, if you all get built up, then it's going to get in the way of us being on top. We know that that's always the case, but it's always going to take folks who really are like, I don't care. I got to figure out a way. And maybe they don't figure out a way, but they at least bring in the energy that a way will get figured out, right? By the next person or by the person after that. And so I was really interested in talking to this person because I feel like that's what they're trying to do. And he also shows up as his whole Black self every time, everywhere. And it is no exception in this interview. I'm really trying to do my best to get folks at least more curious about politics and government, not just in the case of running, but also in the case of like why you should vote. You know, a lot of people, they may say like, oh, I like what this person doing. I like what they at. I like what they on. But they're not going to actually get their ass up and go out and be a part of the voting block. You know, I know there's a lot of folks that listen to this podcast that are still telling themselves, oh, it doesn't matter if I vote. Well, listen, if you live in a city in America, baby, you need to be voting because that is a part of how you are getting to exist in your world. And then you might say to yourself, well, I don't need to worry about this thing or that thing or that thing because I don't have to do this thing or that thing or that thing. But if you live in a society with people who do depend on that, it will inadvertently or advertently come directly to you. So ultimately, the point is that we are a community. And it is community building that's going to be the thing that ends up changing the way that things are going in this country that are actually dismantling communities. And so I really feel like this brother right here, he's working to do that and implement that through policy, through legislation. And, you know, when I say policy and legislation, what I mean to say is through action. Because, you know, you can't just talk it. You got to walk it. Walk it like I talk it. Walk it like I talk it. Skirt, skirt. Let's get into it. Side effects of being the Black mayor of Baltimore with Brandon Scott.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Raise a spoon to Grandma, who always took all the hungry cousins to McDonald's for McNuggets and the play slide. Have something sweet in her honor. Come to McDonald's and treat yourself to the Grandma McFlurry today. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. At participating McDonald's for a limited time.
I've always thought of Black media as a place where we are represented and also protected, as a place where we are uplifted and empowered. And I know that that is sometimes more shown in potential than in actuality, but on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths, we get to see it in real time. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black Stories, Black Truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcasts that center Black voices. It's NPR Noir. Turn on NPR today and hear a range of voices as varied, nuanced, and bliggity Black as the country we reflect. Stories should never be about us without us. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get podcasts. So as y'all can see, we are in a very different setup today. This feels very between two firms. very between two ferns, but we're in D.C. And D.C. is a different kind of Hollywood, all right? It is definitely a different space, but I took the opportunity while I was here to connect to the real ones that are in this space. And to my left, we have the mayor of Baltimore.
What up? What up?
What's going on?
I'm good. You good?
Mr. Scott.
I'm great.
You chilling?
Chilling.
Are you relaxed?
I'm always relaxed.
Okay.
Cool, calm, and collected at all times.
How did that happen?
That's just my nature.
Always?
I grew up in Park Heights in Baltimore, so not much is gonna scare
gonna
me or shake
you.
Me. No, it's not rattling. It's not. I'm the guy you want with the ball in his hands with 2 seconds left.
Really?
Yeah.
That's
Mr. Big Shot. That's what they call me.
So I'm really glad I got this opportunity to talk to you, because really what I've been trying to do lately is just get the folks, the regular folks, to give a damn about what's going on in politics and government, because it really feels like they, and when I say they, I mean white people and people who support white bullshit, have done a great job of creating this chasm between the people and the system that's actually in control of the people. So first and foremost, I just love to know, like, what made you feel like you wanted to get into this space of work in the first place?
Well, I mean, this is a real, real story. So I grew up in a neighborhood of Baltimore, Park Heights, mm-hmm. Northwest Baltimore. It actually, you know, the Triple Crown horse races, mm-hmm. one of them is in my childhood neighborhood, Preakness.
Oh, yes.
So Amanda, imagine living in a neighborhood where one day, the third Saturday of May, your neighborhood literally is the center of the world.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
The whole country's eyes are watching. Uh-huh. But every other day of the year, you're not even treated as human. And I always take it back to, I was playing outside one day in this church lot behind my house, and there was this apartment complex that we called the ranch because it was like the OK Corral from Tombstone, mm-hmm. every day, like violence,
gotcha.
All of that. And I was like 6 or 7 years old, and someone just came and just start busting off shots. Jumped in the bushes, and like the next day, we were supposed to go to school and everything else, like nothing mattered. No, there was nobody sent to school. No one came to the neighborhood to check on us. It was like no one cared. And then shortly after that, one day walking to school, there was like a body found outside of our school. Same thing. We had to go to school the same day. And I remember pestering my parents, my aunts and uncles, right? Like, why no one gives a shit about our neighborhood? And after me annoying them about it, they was like, if you wanted to change, you're going to have to do it yourself. No one's coming to save us. At the same time, my uncle, who owned my family's business, my family has a black air conditioning heating company, mm-hmm. he's getting invited to all these political events and things. So I'm literally going with him, right? Mm-hmm. Because I'm a child that after school, I was with a different person all the time, right? Just the way that black families are. And he would tell me, like, this person ain't shit. That, like they want money from me, but they don't want to invest. And I could learning the system that way. And I made that determination as a young man that I wanted to be the mayor of Baltimore, because who better than someone who had to live through the war on drugs, right? Mm-hmm. Over zero tolerance policing when I was a kid. If we walked outside, right, it was breathing while black. You could be snapped up. It's only through the graces of God that the many, many times that I was sat down on the curb and put in handcuffs for no reason, right? Including one time with my car full of my stuff coming home from college, that it didn't end up in me actually getting arrested.
I didn't know where that sentence was going.
Yeah. Full of it, right? Full of it. Yeah.
Full of it.
DJ equipment, everything, right? And it's only that's a blessing. But there are so many people
Wait. You can DJ?
I do. Yeah. I can. Okay, very well,
like,
actually.
On techniques or?
I started on techniques.
Okay.
Now everybody, of course, is using Serato.
Yeah.
But I'm.
No, I
that's
mean, but
easy.
You
it's a lot easier than it used to be. Have milk crates full of vinyls, techniques, 1200s, no automatic beat mixing, counting, all of that. If I wanted to blend, I had to do it myself. That's how I started DJing. No disrespect to the poor people that started now. But
I mean,
you know,
but kind of.
No disrespect. But yeah, that's what made me want to do it, because I saw it firsthand. I seen it. Like, I had a friend whose mom was struggling with addiction so much that on Christmas Eve, she sold all of his stuff. And my dad pulled me and my cousin aside and said, y'all gonna have to give up some of your stuff so that he can have Christmas too, right? It's also the kind of family that I've come from. And I came to City Hall as a staffer at 23, and I'm 39 now. So I've been there 16 going on 17
years. So this is a career
job? This is, well, Not for the whole entirety of my life. Let me be very clear.
I mean, I don't know. It has been so far.
I'm not fitting to be doing this when I'm 50. I'm going to let you know that. Like, okay. For me, it's one more term and then it's off to other things. It's really about...
It's off to DJ.
No, it won't be that.
DJ Brandon Scott.
I got to tell you.
Friday, this is Martin Luther King Day.
They probably will put... Now, people have had me do it at events, right? But the truth is about DJing. I picked up DJing again during the pandemic. Because I was home all the time, right? And then I started
doing it.
I did it at one event, my high school reunion, right? So that I could give one of my good friends, who's one of the best DJs in Baltimore, a break. Because it's our reunion, our 20-year reunion. And then now everybody wants me to DJ. And
I just tell them, are you trying to say you're nice?
I am. But it's not. But the truth is, what I tell them, like, I'm not doing that. They're like, well, I already got one fucking job where everybody's trying to tell me what to do. I don't want another one. It's
you
got to
make a no request rule. I have a no request rule.
They don't care about that. People don't care about that.
The last time I was playing Michael Jackson, Don't Stop Till You Get Enough, and someone came up to me and said, hi, can you actually put on Drunken Love? I was like, just so we're clear.
That don't go.
No.
You can't do that. Yeah, no. That's why I'm good. Yeah. I got enough. People like, you shouldn't give the money to the schools. You should give it to the recs. I don't want to hear this. No, I'm good. I'll take the first one.
So who do you listen to?
What you mean? Music-wise?
No, like when you said like, you know, it's difficult because I can't imagine people tell me all the time to be in public office. And I'm just like, no, I don't even like y'all leaving comments telling me what to do on Instagram.
I think that you have to listen to your residents, right? The citizens, right? That like for me, I got elected in a different way than most mayors.
Tell us about it. The power structure
had not one, not two, not three, not four, but five other candidates they supported, not me, right? And I still won. And they still mad about it. Big, big mad about it, which I love. But when you come into it.
Who is the power structure that you're talking about? The reason why I'm stopping you is because a lot of people do not know how things happen.
Yeah.
They don't know what is impeding things. They don't know what's excelling things. And so I'm really trying to be more inquisitive.
It's a long, long way to explain this. But one, I think folks have to understand, Baltimore is the birthplace of redlining. One of my predecessors, Mayor Preston, right? Who a street is named after in Baltimore for now. I'll get to that myself later. But passed the first redlining ordinance and then it was taken around the country. So when you see when National League of Cities is showing this map of cities of redlining, it starts with Baltimore, goes everywhere else.
Wow.
So when you think about that structural inequality, that structural racism, right? It started in my city, in the building that I work in, at the desk that I sit in every day, right? And when you take that and then you move into the 60s, the 70s, that kind of time period, and you think about the white business structure, right? And the investments that and the influence that they have had over residents in Baltimore and particularly mayors, right? And the power structure that it is that we did a study a few years ago. I passed the equity law, right? So now we have to do capital budgets, all these things through a lens of equity. We found out that in Baltimore, it's like the Lion King, right? Simba, everything the light touches is ours, right? And Baltimore is like, everything the water touches, you invest in. Everything else, forget about it. Don't touch it. And when you look at that map, and they call it the white L and the black butterfly in Baltimore, is what it's called.
The white L and the black butterfly.
Shout out to Dr. Lawrence, formerly of Morgan State, right? You can see that. And now what we're doing is doing the opposite. We're saying, no, we're going to invest in the opposite. We're going to go in neighborhoods where, you know, they had closed rec centers. We're reopening them and we're doing them there. Mm-hmm. And for people that understand the importance of that, they appreciate that. But for somebody who's used to never hearing the word no, right? No is a powerful word. If you never heard the word no, or you have to follow the process like everyone else, they're going to lose their minds.
Well, you know, there's a two-tiered justice system.
Yeah. Or, you know? Well, why do we have to do that? I mean, this will benefit everyone, but it hasn't. Right? We've been doing this, right? We know what the destination
is. Trickle-down is not actually trickle-down.
It doesn't work. But also, it's not even set up that way for if you invest in this neighborhood and not this one. That like, and when people are like, I believe in equity until we have to go, myself or my city administration go and say, like, you know, you're not getting this anymore. We're like, what do you mean? Why do we not have to get it? Like, this is what this means in practice, right? These folks have to be focused on. So we know that that's going to be, but that's not just for me. That's for mayors like me around the country. Mayor Jones in St. Louis, you know, Mayor Stoney, Mayor Whitfin from Birmingham, right? They're coming at all of us because they see, one, we're going to do the right thing, not the popular one. And two, we can't be bought.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Raise a spoon to Grandma, who always took all the hungry cousins to McDonald's for McNuggets and the play slide. Have something sweet in her honor. Come to McDonald's and treat yourself to the Grandma McFlurry today. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. At participating McDonald's for a limited time.
I've always thought of Black media as a place where we are represented and also protected, as a place where we are uplifted and empowered. And I know that that is sometimes more shown in potential than in actuality, but on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths, we get to see it in real time. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black Stories, Black Truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcasts that center Black voices. It's NPR Noir. Turn on NPR today and hear a range of voices as varied, nuanced, and bliggity Black as the country we reflect. Stories should never be about us without us. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get podcasts.
Tell me what that means, that we can't be bought.
Can't be bought. Literally, you can't be bought. So for me in particular, they're used to being able to like wine and dine mayors and, you know, in some cases, give them money and people had to pay for that because they got caught. They forgot they weren't white. You know, that happens all the time. But they used to being able to say like, oh, well, we can take you here. We can take you there. We can take you out to these restaurants. We can do all of that, right?
Yeah.
Well, for them, unfortunately, I don't drink. I don't eat meat, right? Like, oh, we can take you to the ball game.
So we can't take you to a steakhouse.
We can take you to a ball game and, and take you into a suite and all these other things. So like, well, actually, I hate skyboxes, even though I have one, right? As the mayor, I'd rather sit out there with the fans. So the things that they're used to doing and the way that they were able to coax people into doing things that they want or pushing them to the front, it's because the people built these false relationships. Like these
Can
people were their friends.
Point though that yeah. like these are very basic things that they're
it
doing.
Is.
They're not even doing nothing
but
real
they
extra.
They make people. Well, in some cases, they are. They're giving people money, right?
Okay, because yeah. I was like, a steak dinner is all it takes to get a community center.
They're giving people
like,
money. They buy people.
I remember one time telling my mom, like, you know, oh, my friend said that she's going on a date because you know she just wants the free meal. My mom said, "Is that all your time is worth?"
Yeah. But wait, like, that's a real point though. People don't get that though. Like, yeah, some people can be bought that cheap, right? Because they want to feel like they're part of the club, right? They want to feel like these people are their friends. And as someone who's been in City Hall since I was 23, like I tell the younger elected official now, like when your name no longer has a title on it, these folks are not going to answer your phone call.
Right.
But those people standing on that street corner who have known you your whole life, they're going to answer you. And you have to be able to, when you're done with, don't let this position consume who you are. You're there for a reason. You're there to work for the people. You're there to accomplish everything you can accomplish when you're there, right? And you have to understand, you know, I infamously say all the time, you have to do the right thing, not the popular one, even if it hurts your election. Even if it hurts your politics, right? And that's a scary thing for some people because they can't see past their life in their current role. Like I said after our first one, like if they come and get me 4 years, 8 years, whatever, oh well. But I've been able to do so much that they'll never be able to undo in that time. And that's what really matters.
How do you keep that legacy going once you get out of office? Because I feel like for a lot of folks, it's like, okay, I did my thing. Skedaddle.
Couple of reasons, couple of ways you do that. One, and I preach this, it's not just good enough to have it done while you're there. It has to be written in policy.
Okay.
Policy has to be there, right? equity is the law in Baltimore because I passed it like through the city charter, right? Mm-hmm. Like to do that, they're going to have to convince the voters to undo that. And in a city that's 60% black, God bless them, right? God bless. That's what you have to do. It has to be done in policy. Policy and in structure, right? Like they can't undo the fact that we've opened 6 brand new school buildings, that we've opened 5 rec centers, that we got 5 more. They're not going to be able to undo that work, right? That stuff is going to be there forever. Even some of the, it's hard for them when you started programs like the ones that we've started and expanded, like our violence intervention work or our 911 call diversion, where in a city that has Hopkins Hospital, right? Where we, of course, if we have the best hospital in the world, we can have people other than police officers responding to mental health things,
why
right?
Why do you feel like that's necessary? This is an obvious answer, but I just want you to say it.
Why do I feel like it's necessary? Because you put circles on circles and you put triangles on triangles, right? We don't train police officers to deal with substance abuse and mental health. Why should they be the ones responding out there to it? And in fact, for me, the irony of it, the first person to highlight it for me, other than folks in the mental health space, is a guy, he's former retired major from Baltimore Police, Lloyd Wells, right? He actually now trains other cities on how to do that work through consent decrees and others. He was the major where Hopkins is. And he came to me, I was a council person. He said, Brandon, this is stupid. Why am I sending my officers out to answer a mental health call 5 feet away from the best hospital in the world? Makes no sense.
Right.
And now it's about those systems changing and building up that. It's going to be hard for them to undo that because now folks are used to being able to pick the phone up and call 911 and getting a different response in certain cases. That's what you have to do. You have to do things that will last longer than you're going to be in elected office. That's the most important advice I can give to anybody in elected office. It's not just good enough when you're there. It has to be gone. And you have to do things that you won't benefit from, that they'll be like 30 years later, like, wow, this is how long ago they started this and now it's starting to pay off. And that's hard for some people. You have to break through the ego and all of that stuff to get
strategery
to that.
Strategery.
Yeah. It's not about them, right? I'm paying the bills for people that were mayor when I was 5 years old. That's how it works, right? And you know, it frustrates me. Sometimes one of them, I infamously want to go and dig them up sometimes, but you know, that's the reality.
wait. So what is, I mean, I think for a lot of us who aren't from Baltimore, right? Like our frame of reference for Baltimore is?
The Wire.
That is correct.
If I had a dollar for every time I heard that. Let me take a guess. Omar's your favorite character?
Rest in peace. My favorite character on The Wire. Uh-oh. I mean, Snoop was a fave.
Oh, Snoop is dope. Snoop, it's there. That's right. We know y'all love it. It's cool.
We do.
We know.
We do. But you know, Baltimore, I think for a lot of people, has just been known as that vision. How far would you say Baltimore is now from that vision that so many of us have?
The truth is that the reason why we all hate that show, right, is that that's very much a part of Baltimore's history. But Baltimore is also the place where Thurgood Marshall comes from.
Yeah.
Right? Frederick Douglass was in Baltimore, right? Elijah Cummings was in Baltimore. We're the like city of first. When you think about where the NAACP is, right? When you think about the folks there, Miss Jackson, all of these folks came from Baltimore. And then there are folks like me. When you look at how other cities have been depicted, right? You don't always just like, New York City is not just law and order. It's not that. So where we are now, right, and when most cities around the country, you're hearing like, oh, crime is up in all these Democratic-led cities. Mm-hmm. You don't hear them talking about us anymore.
Tell me about that, because I know that was a very, like—
So the big thing, right?
Purposeful initiative.
As you
to
and
get
I talking,
down.
We're seeing a 20% reduction in homicides, a 10% reduction in non-fatal shootings, and that's despite having a mass shooting where 28 people were shot in one time, which was insane. But it's about all of the things, right? You still have some folks who believe that like the only solution to reducing violence is like, you have to have a police officer everywhere, and that'll make it safe.
They're violent.
If that was the case, Baltimore would have been the safest city in America for a long, long time.
Right.
Because
they've been everywhere.
They were everywhere, right? And now what you have to have is like the evolution of people's thought, right? Like there's a role for them, but also, there's all these other things that matter, right? And even from we'll start since a lot of folks want to start with the basic stuff. We'll start with the basics.
I want to start with a question because you talk a lot and I need to get something in.
You go, go ahead, do your thing.
So
this is your show.
It is. It is. but no, I have a, because what happens in these conversations is politicians politic. Like y'all are very used to like, I have to get everything out because I need y'all to hear everything because this is going to go somewhere and it's going to follow. And I completely respect that.
My chief of staff's going to paint.
Right. Hey, Marvin. hallelujah. But when you say that the police do serve a purpose, what is the purpose that you believe policing should serve?
Yeah, I think when you think about policing in America, right? Like as someone, this is coming from someone, I used to lead the largest anti-violence movement, co-lead it in the city, right? 300 men march. With me, it started out as 1,000 and then it went to 300. It ended up being 30 brothers, black men mainly, would go out and we would intervene in neighborhoods. We would be out there. 9, 10, 1, 2 in the morning, wherever the data said it needed us to be, we would be out in those neighborhoods trying to prevent those things from happening.
Why did the number diminish?
Because I told men that they had to give up every Friday night in the summertime. That's why. Some people fell off because they needed to go to the club.
I was going to say, Friday nights are good for Henny.
They wanted to go to the club. Now, this is about the most important thing. It's just keeping us alive, right?
Right.
Through that and through the work, as Baltimore, we have one of the largest investments into community violence intervention, actually spending $50 million of the ARPA money that President Biden and Vice President Harris gave to me on building that ecosystem. So we have Safe Streets. Safe Streets is where we pay folks that used to be killers, right? Used to be in the game to go out and stop other people from doing the same thing, right? So it works. We know that it works. And we also have a deep partnership with brothers from We Are Us, who are many members from the Nation of Islam and some of our Christian brothers who have got together to form a group. Even those folks, right, from the Nation and others who are out there and folks like me who are out there, we're like, hold on, there are certain things that we can't even do. When you think about the policing part for me, and this is how we focus them, we're never going back to the days where, oh my God, someone was shooting heroin right here. We're going to go arrest that person. That person is sick. They don't need to, they're not inherently criminal.
Right. If they're not,
that was idiotic.
Shooting
right?
somebody while
if they're
shooting
not shooting
heroin.
Somebody, you know, this is stupid, right? We're not doing that. We're not going back to breathing while black, right? But there are things, for example, and this was a big shift for us. We're a city where you and I are talking, we've seized 2,100 illegal firearms this year alone, right? Over 60% of them come from other states. They mostly come from red states, by the way.
How do you know where a gun came from? The serial number, that's it?
Well, they get traced by the ATF. And that's all I can say without getting into further trouble. But you'll see news about that in the future. But we know where they come from because our partners in the federal government trace them, right?
Got you.
They come from other states, most of them, right?
And they come from—
You know Baltimore.
Usually—
You saw the wire.
Red state.
You know
the
that—
The only murder I've ever seen was in Baltimore.
Yeah. You know that Dookie—
Like in real life.
Dookie from the wire, right? Can't get to East Baltimore from West Baltimore. He sure as hell didn't go to West Virginia or Ohio or Georgia to buy that gun that he has in his hand, right?
Right, right.
So for me, what we're focusing our police on, one, guns. Where the guns are coming from. Not just the same way that the same premise that they used to do with drugs, right? Like, oh, they arrest somebody selling weed out in the corner, which, you know, now is a laughable
thought.
But
they're not the plug. Who's the plug?
That's the point. But what did they do then, Amanda? They would work that person up the chain.
Of course.
But they never did that for guns. Now we're starting to make those trafficking cases like, hey, where they're actually coming from. Who's trafficking them? Who's buying them?
The same people that are selling them to other countries.
I got you, but you know, it just, it's a novel thing, right? That then we do have some folks who like, they want to hurt people, but it's so few of them. And instead of living in this world where everybody black in West Baltimore is a criminal, which is what they did when I was a kid, right? There's a small group. We have what we call the focus deterrence or group violence reduction strategy.
Okay.
Where what we do is we went out, did all the academic work. We identified exactly who these people are, right? And then they actually get first a letter from me that basically says, yo, I know who you are. I want you to stay alive. We have all these resources for you to be able to do that. If you need housing, mental health, substance abuse, whatever you need, job training, a job, whatever you need to do, relocation, we'll do it. But if you don't and you continue out here harming people, I got to get you the fuck out of here. That's what we got to do. And a lot of folks take us up on that. They like, all right.
Really?
Yeah, they do.
I was about to say, who?
I'm out. People, because people inherently, folks think about, and as someone who grew up around a lot of street dudes, right? And OGs who are now like, who told me and my friends like, yo, we gonna make sure y'all good because what we doing ain't it.
But isn't there something to be said for the fact that a lot of cats end up in these crime spaces because of lack of access to industry, right? Lack
industry
of access
resources,
to resources, et cetera.
At the back end of what we when I start off when we begin, the back end of purposeful disinvestment, purposeful breakdown of systems. But we know, right? We know that's what happened. And that's why we're going at it in that approach. Like, yo, look, I know. I lived this out just like you did, right? And it's hard to have that conversation with some people because I always had this conversation. I'm like, look, if some of our folks think that black people run a drug game, I'm like, look, I got a moon to sell your ass to. Like, it's not happening. At best, you're going to be a Walmart district manager. That's it. Like, that's it. Most of y'all are going to be greeters at Walmart. Basically, all you're doing all day is standing and saying, welcome to Walmart.
Corner boys.
Right? Yeah, that's all it is. Mm-hmm. And now we just have to get to them in a different way. But most people don't want to live like that. And it's a hard thing for some people to grapple, even our folks, and especially older black folks who have been beat down on with this media drum for all these years, that young black people only want to do these things and they only want to be involved in crime, especially, it used to be solely young black men. Now, increasingly, they're like, look at the young black girls, they're out here shooting, but like we have to break through that and understand that that's a purposeful thing that folks are doing to try to keep us divided.
So I think there's an idea that Baltimore is just a solely black city, but there are white folks in Baltimore.
There are. Plenty of them.
And how do they feel about these initiatives?
It depends on who they are, right? Like, I think Baltimore is a city of neighborhoods, right?
Okay.
But I always tell folks that we have over 220 neighborhoods. It might as well be a city of countries.
Wow.
That's how, different the neighborhoods are, right? You can, in most cities, if you're in this, on this block, the next block don't look the same. In Baltimore, this block can be pristine. You go to the next block and you're like, am I in the same neighborhood?
Right.
Like, so a lot of that happens. Some folks, and this is the...
Why does that happen? Because the
well, go back to redlining and all... No, redlining and all of that stuff plays a deep part in all of these things that happen in the city over time. But when you think about the generational differences too, right? And I used to have this conversation with my grandmother all the time before she passed. For me, Park Heights today is 100 times better than the one I remembered as a child, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it was just off the hook every night. But for her... And to a lesser extent, to my mom and dad, they remember the neighborhood where they left the doors open, right? But I'm like, you guys remember, I was born in 1984. Y'all wouldn't let us go 2 feet outside back then, right? Like, that's the difference. And then you have this thing where, and somewhere along the line, it's not just Baltimore, it's just black people around the country and cities, from their generation to really to ours and those coming behind us, there was this gap where we got all these things. And then we got complacent, in my opinion. We got complacent.
I agree.
We got complacent.
What made us get complacent?
People were eating. They had money. They was at the table. They felt like we was moving. But then you had to know, like,
were they really at the table?
But this is my, in their minds. But if you at the table, you know that they created another table.
Right. It's another, they have a side group chat.
They got, they had a side next tail bloop bloop back in the day. Like, they was going around you. You know that, right? And I think that
But
happened.
I don't think they do know that. Like, I think genuinely, like, there are a lot of folks, like a lot of our folks, black folks, who don't really want to admit that racism never stopped. Like, the actual activism behind keeping it active never stopped. It just morphed. It got different versions.
It was a different thing. They didn't wake up until, you know who got elected. Which, for me, as someone who, my family is originally from North Carolina. I'm a first generation Baltimorean. And I had to spend all my summers on my grandparents' farm, right? So I have a different view of racism. I prefer them the way they are now. Like, out in front. Like, when infamously, you know, I came into office, had an afro, would get all these letters about, like, cutting my hair. You know what they would get in the mail from me?
A pic, please.
Every last one. with my name on it.
I have that pic.
Every last one of them with my name on it, right? But, like, if they're out there, then you know. To your point, it's the ones that are behind that you don't know, that they're, like, smiling in your face and then, like, jabbing in your back. We didn't pay enough attention to that at all. And I think that's the harder part to get people to understand. They think, like, these folks just came out because you know, Trump made them come out. Like, no, they were always there.
They were always there.
They didn't go anywhere. And they're not going anywhere. Like, now you're just going to know because they're dumb enough to wear a hat.
Touche.
That's the truth. But some of that way that those folks think, that mob mentality, sometimes pours into our folks too. And it's like, yeah, we like, no, they ain't wrong about that. And like, lock them up. You know, these conversations that we have. Now, one of the big ones is around legalization of marijuana, right? Mm-hmm. We have it. Like, people are like, oh, they want to call the police because someone's smoking weed. Like, you can't do that. It's legal. And it's no different than you sitting in the house smoking a cigarette.
When did that happen for Baltimore?
Well, Maryland, it was decriminalized a few years ago.
But decriminalized is
but
like...
basically, it was basically legal with the amounts, right? You had to...
Okay.
Yeah. And now it was July 1. It,
my
birthday. Across the state from Maryland. Yeah, it was legal.
Light went up for me.
But it's having those tough conversations and across generations. And I think for our parents' generation, it's sometimes a tough conversation, right? Because we were talking about this in a ride over here. Like, we often hear from the generation immediately before us, like this tone of like, we messed everything up. And I had to remind them, like, I was born in 1984. Do y'all know how crazy Baltimore was from 1984 until 2000? I was born into a city that was worse than it is today. And for them to point the finger at folks coming behind them, like, first, look, Michael Jackson said, you got to start with the man in the mirror. You got to start with the man in the mirror, right? Like, that's where they got to start. They do. But it's a tough conversation because it's not, for me, it's not about saying, like, if you would have done this. It's about, like, okay, this didn't happen. What can we learn from the progress that you guys have made all these years and how we now can see where we fell short and how we move forward? But that's a tough conversation because you have to have some self-admittance to not passing the torch, right? Like, I had to snatch the baton. It wasn't passed to me. They don't want to pass it.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Raise a spoon to Grandma, who always took all the hungry cousins to McDonald's for McNuggets and the play slide. Have something sweet in her honor. Come to McDonald's and treat yourself to the Grandma McFlurry today. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. At participating McDonald's for a limited time.
I've always thought of Black media as a place where we are represented and also protected, as a place where we are uplifted and empowered. And I know that that is sometimes more shown in potential than in actuality, but on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths, we get to see it in real time. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black stories, Black truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcasts that center Black voices. It's NPR Noir. Turn on NPR today and hear a range of voices as varied, nuanced, and bliggity black as the country we reflect. Stories should never be about us without us. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get podcasts.
I know this was always in your vision to be mayor, but I can't imagine that the road was laid out for you. I mean, as you said, they literally were like, here's four other options. Please, please choose any of them but this Afro man. When did you decide that, I don't want to ask when you decide. How did you get to this point? Like, who helped you? Were there any mentors? Like,
oh, yeah.
Because even in the experience space, like, you actually have experience. Like, you came up, like, you didn't just start at mayor. Like, I'll see people right now, like Cornell West being like, I want to run for president. I'm like, Cornell, how you starting with president? Like, can't you just... like, can we start with council member? Like, can we, like...
I didn't intern, but I'm going to run this joint tomorrow.
Yeah, and y'all going to see.
Calvin own McDonald's now.
Like, that to me is like a, there's a privilege there that's odd coming from Cornell, but there's also just like a lack of foresight to like, okay, you don't know how this all works. So I'm curious to know, how in this process were you guided to get to this point and actually be able to have experience? Because the things that you're doing are not things that could just be done. Like right. It takes a lot of politicking. It takes a lot of knowing the system to flip the system. Am I wrong?
Well, I'll say this. I had a few mentors to help me along the way, right? Okay. So I got to, and it's always a black woman, right? You got to start it always. Just the reality mm-hmm. of the world. So when I came to City Hall first, this is a great story. Our former mayor became the governor. The council president became the mayor because that's what happens by charter, right?
Okay.
And then there was an open seat on the city council. This is when I was still living in Parkhurst. I applied for that seat. I didn't get it because they had it predetermined.
Okay.
But the council president at the time, who became mayor, Mayor Rawlins Blake, literally after the hearing, her and one other person talked to me and she was like, I want you to come intern in my office. So that's how I started. I literally started as an intern and then as a staffer, right? And, you know, I was a little spoiled, right? Being the mayor's personal mentee comes perks. With its perks, right? My supervisors hated it because they felt like they couldn't tell me what to do, which they couldn't. But I learned a lot about the system. So I went to college for political science at St. Mary's College in Maryland, the National Public Honors College, the home for the study of democracy, right? So I have the technical background. And then you get the experience at a very young age.
I want to ask you, as someone who only went to get my master's at Columbia, just so that when I talk about things and the people be trying to undermine it, I can be like, I already went to y'all little institution, you know? So my black experience isn't just enough because, you know, they need this other thing.
They need the validation.
Yes. So did you consciously go to that school for that purpose?
No. So this is a whole different sidebar, but no.
We love a sidebar.
I never even visited St. Mary's until August the 30th of 2002, my first day. So I went to Baltimore's largest high school, Mervo, to run track. I was a track athlete.
Are you nice?
Yeah, yes. You don't run track in Mervo if you're not nice. You can't, like, you just don't make
it.
You don't make the team.
Okay.
You don't make, not Chicago. Actually, two people from my school, one made the Olympics twice, and one of my classmates, Frankie Wright, was on the USA's 4x4 World Championship indoor team in 2012. So, like, that's the pedigree of the school. But, quite frankly, I didn't want to run track in college.
Okay.
But I made that decision kind of late. I actually had gotten hurt. I had to go through all these things. I was like, I ain't trying to do all that. And to be honest, I didn't want another coach telling me what I had to do, what class to take, et cetera, et cetera.
So you don't like being told what to do?
No, it's not that. It's that like...
That's
I started running track when
the
I was like six...
right here, right here.
6 years old.
Why are you looking at your phone?
Like dictated. Dictated, right? Like when you're in college, most people get to decide their own majors. We're going to pull a Band-Aid off of something else. When you're an athlete, they tell you what you're going to take.
I ain't going to lie. I did date a brother who was a wide receiver at Texas A&M. They told him, you're going to take poultry science.
Yeah, I'm not doing that.
So that you can throw this ball and catch
it. And I was lucky to be enough in this program, college bound, where I actually didn't have to take the SAT after 10th grade. So my 11th, 12th grade year, I would just like take looking where
so
I wanted to go.
So you took the SAT in 10th grade?
9th grade and 10th grade. And that was it.
You know the score. What was the score?
It's 1,300.
I was going to say, everybody remembers. That's impressive.
That's not even impressive these days.
I
but
was
anyway.
Not good at that test.
Well, the program helped us learn how to take the test. But there you go.
Okay.
So St. Mary's came and they represented the best. They were the institution that had the highest pedigree that was giving me the most financial aid.
Okay.
There you go. There you go.
Right.
That's how I went there. But
did you enjoy it there?
I loved it.
What'd you like about it?
A few things. One, as someone who always likes to hear different viewpoints, right?
Mm.
Like I knew I was going to a place that would be challenging in that aspect.
Yeah.
I really came into myself as a public servant there. Like, so SGA and shout out to, so the way St. Mary's does, right? We're in DC. So Councilman Robert White in DC is my college classmate, right? So, and then the county executive in Frederick County, Maryland was my other college classmate. So there's the pedigree there.
Yeah.
And then it really was the work. And the people, like the work was hard.
Okay.
Like we had to learn everything about policy. It was hard, but we had a lot of fun. And going to school on the beach didn't hurt.
Touche. As an island girl, touche.
You got to party too.
So,
but I also wanted to go to a small school. So St. Mary's is smaller than my high school. So it's 4,000 people in my high school, 2,500 in my college.
Okay. And you wanted to go somewhere smaller just because you wanted to feel like you were a name, not a number?
Well, I didn't want to take another class where there was like 150 people in it.
Yeah.
And I wasn't trying to do that anymore. And I got used to the smaller class thing because my trade, so my high school was like a trade-focused school. So my trade, computer programming, it was only 12 of us. But all my other classes, like 40, 50 people in it.
So you can code a little bit?
Not anymore. That was a long time ago.
But your MySpace page was popping.
It was jumping.
He had the letters had falling down like rain.
I had to embed it. I ain't had to, you know, I did a media player. Now I'm going to embed my music in there myself. So the stuff that y'all don't want me to use, I'm going to put in there. Like, do all of that.
So you don't like people telling you what to do?
No, I don't.
But I think,
that's
I mean,
what
honestly,
my mom would say. And also, that's what my backside would say, too, from a kid's shit.
But I think that's kind of like a necessary role if you're going to be a Black person in public servitude, because there's going to be so much telling you of what you're supposed to do based on what has been done. And nothing that's been done has been for us.
My staff in the room is like, Amanda, you're killing us right now. but you're right, right? And I think it's also for me, it's that, but it's also like this thing of right and wrong. Right. Like my parents will tell you that if I knew I was right and they were wrong, even if they wouldn't admit it, I would look at my father and say, go ahead. You got to whoop my ass because I know I'm right. It's that like it was that.
Same.
I would take it. I would take it every time. Like, yep. Volunteer to take it. Here, go ahead. Do what you're going to do. Just don't tell him I can't go outside. He figured that out when I was 12 years old, though. But that's the truth for me. And I learned that. And I learned
Where did that moral compass come from?
It came from my family first. Like I said, look, it's different. A lot of folks in our generation, this thing about segregation and Jim Crow and all of that is so far-fetched, right? But
it ain't that far-fetched.
It ain't. And especially for me, right? Like I talk to my dad every day. When I go back to visit my family every year in North Carolina, I have to drive past this school that he was in seventh grade when they integrated, that I know that the person that lived in that house and someone whose family still lives there, right? His classmates' dad told them, gave him a gun first day and said, it's okay to go to school and shoot one of them niggas. Like, that's not a far-fetched thing
no,
for me.
That's
like, I can see that, right? I remember being down there with my grandfather when we're taking the pigs that we're about to sell and we get to a place and I'm like, well, granddaddy, let's stop at that store. Nah, boy, we can't go there. Like, I know that. Like,
we can't go there.
And this is understanding that my grandfather, if people see him, they thought he was white, right? And now it's even more so with the blessing of ancestry and me being able to go and see that, like, my family was free in rural North Carolina in the 1700s, right? And I'm like, oh, that's why white people hate me. They never owned me, right? Like, that's why they hate me so much. Racist people, that is. But I think, like, that...
You know,
I
say there's only two kinds of white people. Me and James Baldwin say the same thing. I didn't know that James Baldwin had said this previous, but we right here. There's only two kinds of white people. There's white people and people who happen to be white. That's it.
But I think it comes from that. And then learning from other folks, right? So I've talked about Mayor Rawlings Blake and the opportunity she gave me. But then also, like, I had a blessing in Baltimore. I had Elijah Cummings, right? Like, and I miss him daily, right? I've never been so excited to be in trouble in my life. But when I would get them calls, Brandon, come over to my office. I'm like, damn, I'm in trouble now.
Good trouble.
I did something, right? Good trouble, right? Most of the time. But, like, having him tell me these things. Yeah. But then also something that sticks with me, and I'm going to try not to cry, because I didn't know.
Everyone cries on this show.
No one knew how sick he was. He called me over to his office, and we're sitting there talking, and his staff are Harry, who he never put out of any meeting. He said, Harry, I need you to step out for a minute. And I'm like, damn, I really fucked up this time. What did I do? I'm thinking to myself, what have I done? I've been chilling. And he goes, Brandon, I want to tell you something. You're going to need this sooner than you think. And he says, you always treat everybody, people that agree with you, disagree with you, people that call you everything but the name your mama gave you, with dignity and respect. He said, I want you to keep that. I want you to always treat people that way, because one day, I was only city council president at the time, you're not going to be council president, Brandon Scott. You're not going to be councilman, mayor, whatever you grow to be. You're just going to go back to being Brandon from Park Heights. And you have to be able to go out to that corner and those people know that you're the same person that you were before, and forget everybody else. Your family has to know you were the same person, because people are going to start coming from you. A week later, he was gone. And
a week?
A week later, he was gone.
Do you think he knew?
He had to know. But that was him. He had this foresight that I've never seen in anybody before. Mm-hmm. But he was right. I was leaving his funeral. Mm-hmm. And an elected official, who I'm not going to name,
Why do we not name names? What's that about?
Well, this person I'm not going to name because
they don't deserve it.
They're no longer elected. So why? Okay. They are, the universe has already spoken for them. Called me and said, hey, I heard what you said, because I told this story at the ceremony we had for Elijah. Right. I heard what you said about the congressman the other day. I hope that is the same for you and me, because I want to let you know I'm endorsing somebody else in the race. And my first thought was like, why the fuck are you asking me this today? That was the first. But then people just started coming out of the woodwork, saying all kind of crazy things. I had an illegitimate child. I was doing this. I was, people that are in the quote unquote political sphere were pushing this stuff. And I was thinking to myself like, oh my God, he's really, really gone. Because when stuff like that used to happen for people, one call to Elijah, he was like, stop it.
The buffer was gone.
And it was gone. He would end it. And I think that that's, you know, being around those kind of people really impacts you.
All right, so y'all know how it works. We're going to go to the Patreon to answer some questions. A little bonus section with the mayor right here. Okay, the people have spoken. Uh-oh. So if you want to hear what the people are saying,
let's
and what you
got
to say to the people, head on over to theamandaverse.com.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Raise a spoon to Grandma, who always took all the hungry cousins to McDonald's for McNuggets and the play slide. Have something sweet in her honor. Come to McDonald's and treat yourself to the Grandma McFlurry today. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. At participating McDonald's for a limited time.
I've always thought of Black media as a place where we are represented and also protected, as a place where we are uplifted and empowered. And I know that that is sometimes more shown in potential than in actuality, but on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths, we get to see it in real time. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black Stories, Black Truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcasts that center Black voices. It's NPR Noir. Turn on NPR today and hear a range of voices as varied, nuanced, and bliggity Black as the country we reflect. Stories should never be about us without us. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get podcasts.
The last dose.
I guess my question to you is, what makes Black people being involved in local government so important?
Because local government is where the rubber meets the road, right? No one is going to ask their state representative, their congressman, even the president, like, for anything. They're going to ask their local council person, alder person, mayor. And that's where everything hits. We're the ones that hit the people the most, right? When you think about basic functions, right? If people's trash can't get picked up, like, their world, if they can't get their kids to school, if there's no after school program, if they don't have access to public transportation, if they don't have internet, all of these things, most of which are not the responsibility of local government, but that's who they're going to bring to the table. If they don't feel safe in their communities. And we have to be focused in local government and people. What we have to do as Black people is, one, realize the importance of local government, but also the importance of understanding where all other levels of government flow into that and who to hold responsible, who's on first. How do we support people that are having that long-term vision, not the emotional knee-jerk response to a problem, right? How do we solve and cure ourselves of gun violence, right? This disease that has been plaguing cities for 50 years, right? Versus trying to attack one symptom of it and sticking with the course, right? That's the most important thing that we can do. The things, listen, Sean Carter said, women lie, men lie, numbers don't, right? The data is out there.
Numbers do lie, though.
The data is out there for the programs that work. We know community violence intervention work. We know harm reduction in things with substance abuse work, right? We know these things work. We have to invest in them and don't allow us to be bullied, especially in an emotional way, for us to stop doing them.
Well, there you have it. Anything you'd like to say to the people?
Baltimore is the best city, period.
Two. Yeah,
two. There, we're not number two. The rest of y'all are three. There you go.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.